Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM, is all the rage in education today, with the goal of giving graduates the skills to compete in today's globalized and computer-based world. That, combined with student debt and the increase in online courses, has raised questions about the value of a liberal arts education on a college campus. Is a college's major mission to prepare students for the workforce, or is it a place where they can learn how to learn and develop their critical thinking skills? Our guests believe strongly in the value of a residential liberal arts college and are the co-editors of Remaking College, Innovation and Liberal Arts, a new book. We had hoped to have them here in our Philadelphia studio, but the weather did not cooperate. They do join us by telephone. Rebecca Chopp is the 14th president of Swarthmore College and a professor in the Department of Religion. Before being the president of Swarthmore, she was the president of Colgate University. And Rebecca Chopp, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
Also with us is Dan Weiss, and he's the brand new president of Haverford College, the 14th president, and he comes to Haverford from Lafayette College, where he was president from 2005 to 2013. And Dan Weiss, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you both here. And to you, Rebecca Chopp, I want to put the first question to both of you, but I'll start with you. Is a liberal arts education under some kind of threat or attack? Is that how you see it?
Well, I think it's. I think there are lots of challenges. I think we have three great periods in our history of challenges to liberal arts: 1860s, 1920s, and today, because the business model, technology, demographic changes in our students are changes in knowledge. So I don't see it as a threat to our mere existence. I think this is a time of tremendous transformation. But I do think we have to explain, in an era where people are so concerned and students are so concerned about getting jobs, why a liberal arts education may be, in fact, the very key you need to get that job you want, not only your first job, but your third one, your seventh, even your eighth.
And I will pick up on that, but let me get a response from you, Dan Weiss, as someone who has been a college president from 2005 until today. Do you see a liberal arts education as facing some kind of extinction?
No, I don't think it's going to face extinction, because I think the obvious and demonstrable evidence of the power of liberal arts education is really evident throughout our society. If you look at the kinds of jobs that people have and the careers they pursue who have that kind of training. I think the challenge before us is one of making a clear case for the enduring value of that kind of education. People see the cost of higher ed as so substantial that they want to make sure that they're going to graduate with a job, and therefore they're most concerned about the first job. But as Rebecca said, the value of a liberal arts education is that it really helps you to live a fulfilling and productive life, both privately and within your society. And I think that's a harder case to make, but that's exactly why we've written this book.
Well, let me go back to you, Rebecca Chopp. As you said, there have been some challenges, 1860, 1920, and today. What should a liberal arts education include for today's students?
Well, I think it has to include critical and creative thinking. The ability to communicate, the ability to bring people together to solve the problems of the day. We're going to have lots of people trained across this country to do computer science, to do biology, but what we're going to need is people who know those disciplines, but who can also work in teams, who can knit together the disciplines, who can address the big policy issues of the day. So I think it's about critical and creative thinking. I think it's about communication skills, and I think it's about collaboration.
But is that any different from the mission of any college or university?
Well, I think we do it in a way that is quite distinct, because we put students in very small seminars. We get them involved in very collaborative activity. We're at 24/7 as a residential college. So I do think that liberal education, the kind of academic approach to critical thinking, was born in our colleges and is thankfully abroad in universities, and today is going into community colleges. But it's not just about an approach to the classroom. It's really the complete living and learning environment. Our students have to learn to collaborate and work and live with people who are very different than themselves 24/7 in all sorts of different kinds of ways.
Going back to you, Dan Weiss, why is and I think Rebecca Chopp answered this from her perspective, but why is it important to live on campus? How does that help in a liberal arts education?
Well, as Rebecca said, a big part of what we provide our students isn't just content in the classroom or even the methodologies that help them to learn how to be productive learners for the rest of their lives, although that's absolutely crucial. What students really learn in college more than anything else is how to go about learning productively when they leave and for the rest of their lives, and to have an appetite and capacity to do that. But what a residential community allows us to do is to put our students together with faculty and other members of the community to solve problems, to engage in careful thinking, to learn about other perspectives, and to broaden their own horizons as individuals and develop their skills as collaborators, as colleagues, and as partners. And that is very difficult to do if you don't have a kind of learning laboratory of the sort we have on our college campuses. And that's one reason why our graduates are so successful as team members and community participants when they leave, because they've had that experience in a kind of intensive way during their years on campus.
Well, we have both, we've mentioned the fact that college is so expensive these days. I think the average debt for a graduate of a four-year college or university is something like $30,000. That's a lot of money for someone starting out in their career. I believe at Haverford it costs about $60,000 a year. Is that right, Dan Weiss?
Yeah, that's right.
And for Swarthmore, about $58,000?
Correct.
Why is it so expensive? Let me start with you, Rebecca Chopp.
Well, let's remember that it's not. We can't look just at cost. We have to look really at the real impact for families. So the average financial aid at Swarthmore is $40,000. So most of the students would pay a third of that sticker price. So that's very important. It's a very hard message to communicate. So why does it cost so much?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, we teach small seminars. Students in the 18 to 21-year-old learn best when they're engaged closely with faculty and with other students. So we are a very personnel-intensive place. We provide tremendous services to our students. If our students need help in writing, because today maybe they're not getting great writing skills in high school, we have services in writing. We have a career services. 96% of our students who graduate and go into the workforce are employed. We have a phenomenal career services that will help them get job skills, help them translate the skills they're learning in the classroom, and get job. So again, I think what we do, it's expensive because it's not just a classroom where we're pushing information at them. We're really forming and shaping their character, their skill set, their ability to relate, and we're helping them launch their way into the world.
Dan Weiss, same. I'm kind of toggling back and forth between the two of you here, but help us understand why education at a liberal arts college, that's what we're talking about, why that is so important, or so expensive, rather.
So expensive, sure.
Sure.
Well, I think, as Rebecca said, there are all kinds of factors that are tied into the way we deliver education, but I think there's something more fundamental that's important to talk about, and that is the colleges and universities in the United States tend to be at least the ones that do what we do, and it's not only liberal arts colleges that provide the kind of liberal education we're talking about, but it also takes place in universities. It requires investments, all of which grow at rates well in excess of the cost of living, and it is just a fact of the economy that is true. So skilled labor, for instance, is a very labor is a very expensive part of the cost of higher education, and hiring the best faculty is tied into what skilled labor draws in this economy. And we have seen dramatic increases in the rates of salaries for skilled labor, and by that I mean lawyers and doctors and professors and all kinds of people who have education, advanced education. And faculty salaries have tracked that as just a general phenomenon in the economy. But beyond that, the kind of investments we have to make to provide the outstanding experience that we expect of our colleges, all of those things grow at rates well in excess of inflation. If you want to invest in technology, and in order to do the kind of research in STEM disciplines that you mentioned, Marty, that requires investments in laboratory facilities and other kinds of technology that is typically quite expensive. And so all of those expenses that go into building the experience that is unparalleled in the world, which it is at American colleges and universities, grows at rates really well in excess of inflation. So over time, what that means is the cost of higher ed is very high. We then offset that, as Rebecca said, with significant investments in financial aid so that we can say to every student, if you get into Haverford College or Swarthmore or Bryn Mawr, we will meet your full need to come here so that no one is turned away because they cannot afford to be here. And that's one of the, I think, the most marvelous aspects of higher education in America, that those schools that are seen as most selective are the ones that also provide access and resources for everyone who's capable of attending.
But is there a danger of pricing yourself, I'll toss this back to you, Dan Weiss, of pricing yourself sort of out, even with scholarships and all the help that are given to students, just pricing yourself out of the market?
Yes, I think there is a real risk that if left unchecked, the growth in costs of higher ed would soon bring us to a crossroads. In the book, I talk about that quite a bit in my essay. And I think that we must do a better job of managing those investments that are so important to driving the quality of our institutions with genuine and legitimate concern in the community about affordability. So we have seen this already. Tuition increases are beginning to be lower than we've seen, and technology is something in the news every day about the ways in which it's contributing to changes in higher ed. And I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see very dramatic changes in the way we structure higher ed so that we can find greater cost savings. Because I agree with you. I think we have to find ways to control costs while maintaining our commitment to quality.
And Rebecca Chapp, about a minute before our first break here, but I'm assuming you're talking about, you know, the really good students who graduate from high school. I'm sure their parents, especially for $60,000, $50,000, they want the full amenities. Is that also an issue you have to deal with?
I think parents want their children, the children who come to Swarthmore and Haverford, to have the best possible education. So our parents aren't worrying about climbing walls. I think they're worrying about the books in the library, about the academic resources, about the ability of the biology student to do a research lab, the ability of the linguist student to travel with their faculty to India to study foreign languages. So I think that's what our parents care about, that the child gets really, really well prepared. It's what our alumni care about. That's why they give money to build up the scholarship funds.
And that's Rebecca Chapp. She's the president of Swarthmore College. Also with us is Dan Weiss. He's the president of Haverford College. And the two of them have co-edited, along with Susan Frost, a new book. It's called Remaking College, and it's subtitled Innovation and the Liberal Arts. It's an argument for, if I can say, a residential liberal arts college and education. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radio.com/times@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Flashpoint Theater supports WHYY and presents David Sedaris' The Santaland Diaries, adapted by Joe Mantello, now through December 23rd. For 10 years running, Flashpoint's Santaland Diaries brings Sedaris' lovable curmudgeonly Crumpet, the Macy's elf, to life, making audiences laugh until they cry. Flashpoint Theater is located on Sansom Street, 2 blocks from the Avenue of the Arts. For tickets, 267-997-3312 or flashpointtheater.org.
Home birth sounds cozy. Your own room, a tub, or a candlelight, perhaps.
I want it to be up moving. I wanted it to be as natural as possible.
But is it safe?
I don't think there's any question that home birth is dangerous.
I'm Mike and Scott. Next time on The Pulse, the fight over home birth.
Women are not getting accurate information.
And what role should midwives play?
We're not untrained. We're not witches.
The Pulse, Friday at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, world leaders honor the late Nelson Mandela, but long before politicians got on his bandwagon, musicians were there. Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You probably noticed that the college landscape has been changing pretty dramatically. Student debt has skyrocketed. Thousands of people are taking courses online, and pressure is mounting for college grads to have a practical skill set. How and where does the residential liberal arts college fit into all of this? And that's what we're talking about with our guests. Rebecca Chopp, the president of Swarthmore College. Dan Weiss, the president of Haverford College. And again, co-editors of a new book called Remaking College, Innovation and the Liberal Arts. And our phones have exploded here at 1-888-477-9499. Dan Weiss, let me go back to you. And I'm curious about then, if we're talking about a liberal arts education, how do you measure success? How do you know you are doing the job that you want to be doing at a liberal arts college?
Well, we measure success all along the way. We first of all measure the progress of our students through a rigorous curriculum by tracking their ability to graduate on time. And colleges like Haverford and Swarthmore typically lead the nation in graduation rates. They're over 90% around for generally for the institutions like that. So we first measure their ability to actually complete the work they set out to do. And then we track their ability to accomplish their goals, and we follow them throughout their lifetimes. Our employment rates for students graduating from college right away are very high, and typically within 6 months or so, well over 85 to 90% of our students have employment. Mm. And then we follow their progress throughout their careers. But one of the things that's more difficult to measure is if the objective is to help students be prepared for productive and rewarding lives, it is difficult to say 2 years after they graduate that mission has been accomplished. So we try to maintain contact with our students throughout their lives, and that's one of the things our alumni programs help us to do, to see what they're doing and how they're accomplishing that.
Same question to you, Rebecca Chopp. And you know, employment is one measurement. I'm also wondering whether doing good in the world is another measurement.
Precisely, and that's just what I was going to add on top of Dan's good answer. So these colleges, liberal arts colleges, and most especially colleges like Swarthmore and Haverford, were formed in the Quaker tradition, and we're really about using knowledge to improve the world. So we provide lots of encouragement to students. We have something called the Lang Center for Civic Engagement and Social Responsibility. A lot of our classes have internships and our collaborative learning experiences out in and around Philadelphia or in other places in the world. So it is a big focus of our education. It is harder to measure, but as Dan said, what we do is measure the output. We rely upon our alumni. So we do surveys of our alumni. We survey each alumni at every fifth year so that we have very complete data. And we do special surveys as well, but every fifth anniversary or so of the graduation is the important survey. And in that survey, we ask our alumni their civic engagements, how they're using their knowledge to improve the world, et cetera. I like this question very much because one of the points we have to understand in this country is that education has to help people have jobs and professions, mm-hmm. but it is also a social good. That's why we've invested so heavily in education in this country. We believe in educating not people just for jobs, but also to help improve society.
Let me quote something from the New York Times from the fall, and this was an article. The headline says, as interest fades in the humanities, colleges worry. A quote here talking about Stanford University, some 45% of the faculty members in Stanford's main undergraduate division are clustered in the humanities, but only 15% of the students. It goes on to say that Harvard had a 20% decline in humanities majors over the last decade. And Dan, I guess I'll go back to you, but Rebecca Chopp, I want to hear from you as well, whether there's declining interest in the humanities coming from the students or maybe even from their families.
Well, I think we see evidence of that throughout our society, that as people become more concerned about employment and what they see to be the instrumental steps needed to secure that employment, the humanities are not always seen as the most obvious path forward. But throughout the history of higher education, we have seen the ebb and flow of disciplines. That's just one of the characteristics of the ways in which our institutions operate. Both Rebecca and I are trained as humanists. It just so happens that we're now administrators. Many of our graduates who have whatever degree in the humanities they might have go on to do all kinds of different things that may not be strictly humanistic. But I think it is true that nationally there is a movement away from the humanities. I'm not unduly concerned that we're heading towards the extinction of the humanities. They are what give our lives meaning, and we all rely in fundamental ways on the quality of our day-to-day lives because of the arts and humanities. I just think that that we are going through a market phase that we'll manage.
Well, Rebecca Pachaud, let me just slightly change the phrasing of my question. I'll put it to you, and then we'll get to some of our callers here. But I'm wondering whether, even as a society, we value and pay poets and philosophers and artists, pay them the kind of salary so that they can go through a liberal arts education and know that they have a job that could support a family at the other end.
Well, it's a good question. Marge Garber, who's a very famous cultural studies scholar at Harvard and a graduate of Swarthmore, makes the argument that we almost have to engage in patronage for the arts and the humanities, that we in universities and colleges really do need to understand that we, at this point in our culture, are need to sponsor them. And as Dan says, times, you know, will change, I think. But one point I wanted to make is, you know, I see many, many, many students who are combining majors or are doing majors and minors. So we have lots of engineering and art students, lots of biology and theater students, lots of people who are studying English, but they're also going to double major in linguistics. So the whole emergence of double majors and minors and majors are also important. I think these students hunger for the humanities and the arts, and I think they're finding ways to do it. But it is absolutely the case that the traditional solo major in religion has really diminished, or the solo major in philosophy.
Well, you're a religion professor, are you not? Coming from you,
Deborah Chop.
But, you know, and we get a lot of interns on Radio Times. We draw from the Philadelphia region. We've had interns from Swarthmore, from Haverford, and other colleges as well. And I just have to say, I'll toss this to you, Dan Weiss, and then we'll get to our callers, is at least this group of students, they don't seem to see things in the kind of categories that I have been talking about on the air here. They seem to be interested in everything and willing to sort of combine all their varied interests and passions.
I think that's exactly right. One of the most heartening things about this generation of students is the creative ways they're thinking about their own experience and how they might contribute to our society. And they don't draw the same boundaries that we do around areas of discipline and whether they're a humanist or a scientist. They, as Rebecca said, they engage in all of this. Mm-hmm. We are also enormously fortunate to have the finest students in the country at these institutions. And these are students who are well prepared, they have lots of experience in being students, and they're able to explore all of those interests. But throughout the system of higher ed in the U.S., there are 21 million people in college, and not all of them have access to that same range of experiences. And it is true for many of them, they don't have the luxury of exploring the humanities the way our students do.
In fact, most students don't go to colleges such as yours, Dan Weiss.
Correct. They do not. That's very true.
But no, I don't want to have this as an either-or conversation. I mean, it seems to me that when it comes to higher education, we need everything to help the students and also to help the country, Rebecca.
I so much agree. I think one of the great strengths of our country has been this kind of democratization, a diverse education system. I mean, I have family members who've gone to vocational school, family members who've gone to community colleges, family members who've gone to big state schools. I was the first in my family to go to college, and I went to a liberal arts college. I think we should see it as a strength. I think we don't have to have one size fits all, and we shouldn't. The jobs are too diverse. The social responsibility is too great.
And that's Rebecca Chopp, the president of Swarthmore College. Also with us, Dan Weiss, president of Haverford College. And again, co-editors of a new book called Remaking College, Innovation and the Liberal Arts. And it's their case for the important role that a liberal arts education plays in a student's life and in a country's life, in a community's life. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Michelle from New Hope has to say. Michelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a teacher in an independent school, a Montessori school, and also a parent of a 16-year-old in a Quaker boarding school. So I'm finding the conversation really interesting. My son is looking at becoming a writer and looking for liberal art education. One question I have, having two older children who have graduated with liberal arts degrees and are sort of struggling to get that first job in the market, you talked earlier about what is the role of a liberal arts school and how is that changing. One question I have is, what are you doing to help translate passion and interest into the field of careers that are possibilities? And also, I find it ironic that our kids are so connected online globally, but when they leave college, what I'm seeing from my children is that their exposure to what a first entry-level job looks like is completely fictional in their head. They have no insight or inside look into what these sorts of jobs would be. They can imagine where they'd be 10 years down the road once they've got some experience, but they really haven't been shown anything in terms of that first step. What are colleges doing to use the advantages of technology to get these kids to really envision and see firsthand what's available?
Oh, it's an interesting question. And Michelle, Dan Weiss, let me toss that first to you, the idea perhaps of a more modest or humble first job, and how do you get the kids into it?
Well, I think it is an excellent question, and we all face this at one level or another. What we're doing here at Haverford, and I think it is happening at colleges and universities across the country, is acknowledging fully that we have to do a better job of working with students in helping them to prepare for careers, even though we say that we want them to focus on their education and to broaden their horizons and to study the arts and humanities and the sciences. We also want them to understand what the real world looks like. So what we've done here, and it's not unique, but we've created a Center for Career Services that is fully integrated with the academic division of the college so that our students have opportunities to be mentored both from faculty and from career professionals along the way so they can begin to shape a vision for what they're interested in doing or what they want to explore through internships or interviewing for jobs, and to learn how to think about those questions and how to present themselves and how to prepare resumes and how to do interviews and how to operate, because students are often not well prepared. It is a paradox that they have access to all this information in the world technologically, but they don't always know how to manage these kinds of challenges. And we're doing that in a much more explicit way than we did just a few years ago.
Rebecca Chopp, do you want to add to that?
Yes, I agree with Dan. I think we at Swarthmore and many other colleges are really focused on this right now. So our students, 70% of them each and every year go into career services. Almost all of our students will go through career services at some time during their 4 years. There they will take courses that translate their skills that they're learning into the job market. They will get externships where they will go follow a lawyer or a doctor or a grade school teacher around to look at. They will do internships where they will spend a summer working very closely at an entry-level job under the supervision of someone. We have also started a Center for Innovation and Leadership, and this center brings back our alumni using often technology, but also face-to-face, to do business competition conferences, to talk about the real world, to sit with them in small panels or groups to help them understand what the world is like. I think this is a curious question that the caller asks, because we're seeing in the millennial generation, I think because of the web, when they think job, they think about the job that somebody gets at 35 or 40. So I think parents and schools have to work together to help people, help our young students learn the kind of progression up the ladder, so to speak, in a career.
And it seems to me there's nothing wrong with waiting on tables.
nothing wrong with it, and lots,
having
and
done
lots
it.
Of our students do it.
Indeed.
Yes, indeed, that's right.
Let me see. Michelle, thanks for the call. Let me see what Ed from Huntington Valley has to say. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
And my comment was related to something mentioned by Mr. Weiss from Haverford, and that is that this is really kind of a narrow view of liberal arts education, meaning that Swarthmore and Haverford are excellent colleges, and students come from all over battling to get in there. But I think the experience that most liberal arts students have is very different at other schools, what we might call a second-tier or third-tier school. The students don't have these intimate 12-person seminars, and so their educational experience is very different. And then also the reputation of the university is different, so they don't have access to the same opportunities after graduation. So if they go to a lower-ranked school and study, say, computer science or accounting, I think that they'll be able to find employment afterwards. But if they major in history at a fairly obscure school, their opportunities are going to be extremely limited. And so, again, I think that the broader view might be a little different than what we see at the Haverfords and Swarthmores of the world.
No, fair enough. And you know, we're looking at these kinds of schools, knowing it's a narrow lens. Ed, that's a very good question. Let me see what Dan Weiss has to say in response.
Yeah, Ed, I agree entirely. I think we have the luxury of talking about our perspective on liberal education and liberal arts colleges from places that are among the most selective in the world. But both Rebecca and I believe deeply that the core values that are at the foundation of this educational experience can and should be replicated everywhere. And it is true the mix of subjects that students would study at other schools might very well be different, and indeed we're seeing that. But the fundamental skills that we're talking about around communication and analysis and reading and writing effectively are the ones that will sustain people in any career that they may pursue. It's also true that these colleges and universities around the U.S. and around the world seek to replicate the model of Haverford's and Swarthmore's. We see it at the Honors College at the University of Michigan. We see it at Yale College within Yale University. We see it at the new Yale University, the Yale College division within the National University in Singapore. That, and we also see it among all what you might call the less selective colleges around the United States. They're all seeking to hang on to as much of that kind of learning experience as they can. But we fully acknowledge that that's very difficult because of the general economic pressures that we're finding. And these issues are explored in the book really, rather fully, actually.
Rebecca Chopp, again, we're almost up on a break here. Anything you want to add to what Dan Weiss just said?
I really do, because I went to one of those colleges that Ed was describing. I went to Kansas Wesleyan in Salina, Kansas. It was by no means did it then or now have the resources of a Swarthmore. But I would still say the faculty engagement was phenomenal. The residential experience, very, very important. So let's don't undercut these schools, because I think they're also providing a unique experience. Dan and I last year went to the Council for Independent Colleges, where we worked with a lot of college presidents from all the tiers, certainly including the second and third tier. My big learning was that I had so much to learn from some of those presidents, because the shortness of resources forces them to get very, very creative. They're doing some marvelous things.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the value of a residential liberal arts education. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
The University City Science Center supports WHYY. In Greater Philadelphia, innovation means business, and the Science Center is at the core of that business. They unite our region's entrepreneurial ecosystem, convening the resources, funders, and people that move ideas forward. For more than 50 years, the Science Center has helped transform ambition into success, fueling the growth that strengthens our region. The University City Science Center. More information at sciencecenter.org. That's sciencecenter.org.
On the next Fresh Air, leaked documents about the secretive organization ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. It brings together state legislators with corporate representatives. Together, they write model legislation that the legislators bring back to their states. We talk with Ed Pilkington, chief reporter for The Guardian U.S., who broke the story of these documents. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
An end to poverty from the mouths of babes.
I will give people presents, like kids who don't get presents with my own money out of my pocket.
An 11-year-old named Dasani who lives in poverty in New York City, where the New York Times says the number of homeless children is higher than at any time since the Great Depression. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. If you're just joining us, our guest is Rebecca Chopp. She's the 14th president of Swarthmore College, also a professor in the Department of Religion, and she was the president of Colgate University before she became Swarthmore's president. Also with us is Dan Weiss. He's Haverford's 14th president. In fact, became president this year. He came to Haverford from Lafayette College, where he was president from 2005 until 2013. We're talking about their perspective on a liberal arts education, a residential-based liberal arts education, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Dan, if I can go back to you, and I'm just interested, since you've been a college president for, gosh, almost 20 years now, what are the most sort of dramatic changes that you have observed as a college president?
Well, I think one of the most exciting and rewarding aspects of this job is to be around young people as they have, you know, for most of them, the most exciting and rewarding experiences of their lives. And they just keep getting younger. So those graduate and the next group comes. The changes, however, have been really dramatic. I think the major one was following 2008 and the major economic downturn that led to our rethinking almost everything we do around financial operations and sustainability of our investments, how we use technology, the impact of demographic changes in our society, and I think most important, increasingly public skepticism that higher education in this country is doing what it's supposed to do. And that's what prompted Rebecca and me to write this book, because we think that debate is crucial and it needs to be on the terms that I think are most accurate. And so that change has been very significant. It's a little bit like healthcare in the U.S., I think.
Well, that's interesting. And the idea is that colleges aren't doing what they're supposed to do, in that graduates don't have the requisite skills and knowledge to make it in the adult world?
No, I think that the changes that the economic challenges that confront all of us have a significant impact on graduates, but also the public perception that colleges are doing what they're supposed to do for our young people is changing in ways that's been more skeptical and, I think, more critical. That's not a bad thing, because I think that debate and discussion is crucial. We make a greater investment in higher education in this country than almost anything else, and therefore everyone has a right to understand exactly what we're doing and how we're doing it. So the biggest change I've seen is that higher level of accountability and the desire to understand exactly what we're doing and why we think it's the best way forward.
Rebecca Chopp, again, you want to add to that, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Two things I would add to that. One, we are moving into a networked age, and we were talking earlier about students who combine all sorts of interests. We're seeing that within knowledge itself. It's seeping out of the departmental silos and becoming far more problem-based. It's one of the most innovative and exciting times in terms of just what counts as knowledge, how technology influences teaching and learning. Amazing. Second, the students have changed. I had my first teaching job in 1981, so I've been at this for a long time. And I would say this: the millennial generation is a fascinating generation. They are job-focused, but they also care deeply. They are scared about the world in which they're going into. They're worried about environmentalism. They're worried about how the changing demographics of this country, what that will mean, and they're getting increasingly worried about the inequality and the poverty in this country. It is a career-focused, morally engaged generation of students. And I have not seen that combination since I have been teaching.
Let me see what looks like Becky from New Hope has to say. And Becky, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to thank both your guests for running liberal arts colleges. I am a student at Arcadia University with Asperger's who spent 10 years out in the real world trying to get into a four-year school to pursue my dreams as a scientist. And without the liberal arts education at Arcadia, I don't think I would have been prepared to go into graduate school, which I'm hoping to do within the next year. I graduate this month, and without a liberal arts education, I don't think I'd be there.
Well, that's it.
So thank you both very much.
Well, Becky, that's really nice of you to make the phone call. Dan Weiss, you want to respond to her call?
Well, that's a very uplifting story, Becky. We wish you all the best. But it is exemplary of what colleges, this sort of education, can provide for people, connecting them to their dreams, making them real. Becky, clearly the credit is all to you, but we certainly congratulate you.
And her call, Rebecca, reminds me of some shows that we've done about doctors' education and the idea of teaching literature and poetry to aspiring doctors, students who are in medical school. The idea is that you can't really deal with a patient if you haven't read some poetry. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I was once provost at Emory, a very large university with a large medical school in public health, and the doctors all the time said they needed people who knew how to listen to Beethoven, who understood poetry, who had a special way of hearing and listening and understanding the depth of tragedy and also the incredible skies of hope in people.
Let me see what Fiona from Reading has to say. Fiona, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Thanks for the program.
You're welcome.
I came to the United States to go to liberal arts college following the advice of my sister in the U.S., my older sister in the U.S. I came out with a philosophy degree from Wellesley College in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. I come from a country where your fate is decided at 13. Basically, you know, you go toward studying toward liberal arts or technical. You know, your fate is decided. But I came here as young enough, and I enjoyed liberal arts education in a small girls college in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out, though, I was a philosophy major and went to work for an NGO, and right away I got a job. But then I decided, well, I wanted to be a doctor in a foreign country, maybe go back to my home country, I don't know. And it's thanks to a liberal arts education that trained me how to think and critical thinking skills, I was able to re-educate myself. I went to Columbia post-bac. Yeah, I have a lot of debt. I don't care. I paid off little by little. But Columbia post-baccalaureate pre-med program, and I just finished my residency in family medicine, and I got my first job in Pennsylvania.
You know what, Fiona?
Pennsylvania.
Let me take your call because I think it raises some interesting points that we've been talking about. And Rebecca Chopp, let me toss it back to you. And the idea is of a liberal arts education, which is teaching someone how to think or how to learn about learning.
Correct. I think, you know, it goes kind of back to the very first thing we were doing. What do these schools do uniquely? And what our promise is we will teach you to learn what you need to know. This is what I hear from our alumni time and time again. Most people these days don't have just one job. You can't prepare them just to be a computer scientist. They're going to be a computer scientist, then they may run a business, and then they may go work for a major nonprofit. So learning how to learn. I also want to underscore the relevance of this type of education internationally. The caller represents that so well. We are now seeing people from around the world starting liberal arts colleges and coming to look at liberal arts colleges and liberal education. We have just started at Swarthmore Institute, in fact, to help promote liberal arts. It's fascinating to me as this country questions liberal arts, other countries around the world, China, Korea, Ghana, lots of countries in Europe, Hong Kong, are either taking their undergraduate programs and trying to make them like ours or starting separate liberal arts colleges.
Dan Weiss, we got an email. Oops, it just went away. But the gist of the email is we should have a liberal education starting in kindergarten and going all through school, including high school. I'm assuming you would not argue with that idea.
I would not. I think the issues associated with what young people should be learning in primary and secondary school is another topic of great importance. And if liberal education were a bigger part of that, that would be a good thing.
Talking about, though, reinventing a liberal arts education, and I'll put this to you, Dan, and then we'll get back to our callers. The idea is that you have to have faculty sign on to some of the innovations that we have been talking about. And my experience living on this planet for many decades now is that most institutions resist change, at least initially, until they can sign on board. Have you found some resistance among faculty to embrace some of these new ideas about a liberal education?
You know, it's interesting. That gets discussed quite a lot, but I think actually it hasn't been the case. First of all, I would say that what Rebecca and I learned more than anything else in this book project was how widespread and deep-seated innovation is all over the spectrum of colleges and universities in the country. You could go to any campus and ask them how they're responding to these changes, and they'll have a story that's interesting and worth telling, because actually people are so committed to the mission, they're paying attention to how to modify it to continue to meet the needs of students. I think the challenge, though, is that institutions like ours, we are 180 years old. We are among the oldest and most successful institutions in American history. And we make changes deliberatively through a shared governance system, and it often takes a little bit longer. So in order to be one of the challenges for presidents and other leaders, how do you navigate those kinds of community changes in an environment that demands quicker response time than we've done historically, but that respects that shared governance and those commitments to consensus decision-making that actually help us to make good decisions? And that's something that Rebecca and I think about a lot, these questions. But we are making changes quite rapidly, and our faculty are right with us. As long as they understand what it is we're trying to accomplish and it's consistent with our mission, they're there.
Let me see what Chris from Fishtown has to say. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I just want to thank everyone for the time.
Sure.
I'm actually a returning student at Temple University. I'm 31. I've earned 3 associate's degrees, and last spring, I just made a decision that I wanted to complete it. And it's one of the most frustrating experiences that I'm having this semester at Temple as a journalism student. I just feel like a lot of the universities, and I don't think it's restricted to Temple, they really have like a one-size-fits-all protocol for the 18-year-old student who is a residential student or lives on campus, and they really have their whole entire day to balance or to dedicate towards anything that the school might require from them, whereas students in my situation, we have to balance out a sustainable work schedule with a productive academic schedule, and a lot of the times, I think administratively more so, I feel like I'm not getting my money's worth, only because, like, if I need to make an appointment to sit down with a counselor, that's a day, that's a half day off of work that I need to take, and I just want to know if there's any, if they're trying to break out of that, or if there's any more recognition towards returning students.
Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I'll give you a chance to respond to that, Rebecca Chopp. How do returning students, I guess, fit into this model that we've been talking about?
Well, first of all, let me say it's a very important question.
Yes.
So based on the research that Dan and I have done, I think it is fair to say that the majority of education in this country is shifting away from simply the 18 to 21 model. Mm-hmm. We will continue to have that. Places small like Swarthmore will continue to focus on that. But we're going to see more and more people go to education across a lifetime. So this question is extremely pressing. Technology will help. I think we're going to see more schools offer technology. And I think schools are starting to add more programs that allow the kind of flexibility. I predict that in 10, 15 years, we are going to have the whole assumption of how we package most of our curriculum, how we provide most of the coursework, will be much more tailored, for the individual student and much less a template. I mean, we still operate all of our schools on a kind of agrarian model, giving the summer off so people can go work in the fields.
Exactly.
But 98% of us in this country are now urban.
Let me squeeze one more caller on. We've got Peter from Cranberry, New Jersey. Peter, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for your marvelous work.
Thank you.
I went to Ursinus College, another wonderful liberal arts school, and worked for RCA for many years. I had a lot of success there in employing students from Drexel through their co-op program. So I was wondering what the presidents thought about the concept of the colleges networking with area corporations to employ students during the summer, giving them helping to meet that challenge of employment after graduation, and also making their courses more relevant, bounced off their summertime experiences.
Peter, I appreciate the call. And Dan Weiss, I'm going to give you the last word and a chance to respond to his question.
Well, it's a great question. Peter has it exactly right. This is the way in which colleges and universities need to develop programs to help students. We're doing it at Haverford. They're doing it at Swarthmore. We have internships of all sorts. We have a career services office that links to corporations, because the more we can help students to prepare for what comes next, the more value they can get out of what comes now in the college experience they're having today.
So a good time to be a college president, Dan Weiss?
Yes, it is. It's a time of great change and opportunity and some sleepless nights.
Well, I guess I'm giving you the some sleepless nights. Sleepless nights for you as well, Rebecca Chop.
Yeah, it's an incredibly challenging time. Like Dan, I've been a college president or administrator for many, many years, and This is one of the most challenging times. But there's nothing more important than education. Well, its role in our society is extremely important, and I think we feel privileged we can help in whatever small way we can.
Well, I have to say that every time we do a show about some facet of education, we always get lots of phone calls, and I appreciate those phone calls indeed. And Rebecca Chop and Dan Weiss, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And again, Rebecca Chop, the 14th president of Swarthmore College. Dan Weiss is Haverford's 14th president. And we were talking about the value of a liberal arts education. And again, they have co-edited a book called Remaking College, Innovation and the Liberal Arts. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.